you're going out on an unauthorized pre-dawn raid to steal millions of dollars worth of gold that a murderous tyrant stole from someone else, you'll need a caffeine jolt. But the war is over. You don't have to settle for that army-issue sludge, and you won't need hundreds of pounds of Iraqi gold bullion to upgrade to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium fair trade Arabica beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend, for those of you that like a little variety in your life. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this fantastic coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is now offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So, what are you waiting for? Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
I don't care what you say. I'm making soup with that bouillon.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, cool kids. We like to offer up so many thank yous for spending some time with the Next 171 Project. We're the voice of classic movies in the podcasting game, so subscribe to us and you won't be sorry. Well, the voice, I said, the voice! Probably lots of voices. Anyway, we're the best one. We glance at the AFI's 123 choices for the 1998 and 2007 lists of grandest motion pictures and got through that venture nearly, I wrote down three, but it's nearly 4 years ago. I thought it was still three, but oh my god, it's almost been 4 years since that ended. Those episodes had spoilers, and so will this one. I'm the bored soldier fighting to save innocent oil in a foreign land. That oil didn't hurt anyone. Ryan Ellis. And here's the finder of Iraqi ass maps. My Goonie Bird and my wife, Bev.
That's me.
Why aren't we calling each other Goonie Bird?
You're right.
If nothing else, this movie can give us that. We'll probably forget about it in an hour from now. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, and it might be a little bit appropriate considering this part of the world is, again, in flames. I guess it always is, but especially the last couple months. And it is Three Kings, which had a great scene showing what happens to your body when you get shot. How many of the four main characters take a bullet? In which order are they shot? And how many of them die from their wounds?
I think it's three out of the four. First, it's Archie gets shot in the arm. And I think that...
Just a flesh wound.
Next is Spike Jones.
That's Conrad.
And the last is Wahlberg.
That's Troy Barlow.
Is that right?
You're right.
Ayo.
The one but guy, bring this up.
He's because he's protected
the
by Jesus.
The black guy doesn't get shot.
But also because the whole film he says, I'm protected by Jesus.
Still.
Nothing will happen to me.
I love that concept, though, that the black guy's the one guy that doesn't get shot. And who dies? Anybody?
Oh, Conrad.
Of course. We know Conrad dies.
Yeah, Spike Jones. Because... Not that anybody seems to miss him. They don't seem to mourn him for very long. They're like, it's okay. He was an idiot. And then they just carry on with their lives.
It's a nice little moment where they all mourn him as he's laying there dead.
It's definitely implied no one's going to miss him.
I happened to watch Ocean's 11 a few days ago. Still enjoyable. Wahlberg could have been in that, by the way. He was apparently supposed to play the Damon part. Wahlberg was with Clooney in this. Then he was with Clooney in The Perfect Storm the year after this. And then that would have been the year after that.
Has he ever done a Soderbergh film?
Wahlberg?
Yeah.
I don't know. But he wasn't in that. But I was also reading, and this seems wrong to me, IMDb could be fully wrong, Spike Jones was supposed to be Danny Ocean before George Clooney was.
That's a different movie, to say
and
the least.
And Soderbergh and Clooney at this point had their production companies, so they worked together regularly.
Spike Jones, he's never been a star. He's never had a movie that he's been the star of.
As an actor, no.
And in fact, he hasn't really acted in all that much. He was in Wolf of Wall Street.
But ironically, he is in Moneyball,
but small parts.
He's acted more than he's directed. He's only made four movies as a director. We're going to cover one very soon. But he's only directed four films. He's acted way more often. In small parts, granted, but he's acted more often than he has been behind the bullhorn.
He's had kind of unusual career, maybe because his family's very rich and he doesn't need to work, so he can just pick and choose projects based on what he wants to do.
And he does music videos whenever he wants. I guess that's still his primary focus.
Does he still do a lot of music videos?
I don't know, but he was for a long time.
Yeah, he was. He did amazing music videos.
Okay, Four Kings, as Roger Ebert points out. This movie should have been called Four Kings, but they want to do the We Three Kings of Orient, which I think Conrad even sings at one point. was released just over 20 years ago by Warner Brothers on October 1st, 1999. The picture was not a hit in this part of the world and didn't do that well worldwide either. Just making back the budget is not a hit at all. And it did that worldwide, but it needs to double or even triple it to make it justifiable.
It's kind of a cult classic now.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, explain the cult classic, Bev, with the Three Kings, Four Kings, whatever, skinny.
It's 1991, and as the Gulf War is wrapping up, four soldiers have a plan to go home wealthy by stealing some of Saddam Hussein's ill-gotten gold. But their heist takes them into parts of Iraq where America's foreign policy has left innocent people vulnerable, and these soldiers have to choose between getting rich and doing the right thing.
Always do the right thing.
And that is exactly what they do. Predictably.
Thank you, Spike Lee. Or, in a nutshell, what 1999 film co-star Jim Gaffigan, maybe from Arrested Development, and the guy who played the fish in The Shape of Water and has a lot of thumbs? This guy!
Doug Jones is in this?
I saw his name in the credits. I was looking for obscure people because we had forgotten Alia Shawkat is Amir's daughter, who's in the movie a lot.
You don't recognize her at all. She's so young.
And apparently her father is Iraqi. I don't think she has any dialogue, does she, in Iraqi? She says, mama, mama. That happens a few times. I don't think she really has dialogue beyond that. You know, she has two broken arms as well. Two casts on her arms.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Man, this family goes through some shit in that one day. The mother gets shot in the head for no good reason. We'll get to that in a few minutes. And the father's being tortured when these guys go in there to steal their gold. And the girl's already had broken arms. Jesus. But anyway, the point of my nutshell is that, yeah, Jim Gaffigan is the guy who, and I think he's even credited as the soldier who cuts Troy's cuffs so he can do that little thing with his lungs.
It's hard to recognize, too. He looks so different. He's young.
And then Doug Jones is dead Iraqi soldier.
Oh, so he's a corpse.
But he's still in it. It counts. Also, Brian Bosworth is in this.
And it's an early Cliff Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he's not quite as famous, but...
Been a lot of things, though. This isn't the most famous, but Whale Rider as the main girl's father.
Fear of the Walking Dead.
Oh, that's right, yeah. That might be a more famous thing. A lot of big-name people in this in smaller roles. Jamie Kennedy, I guess, wasn't a small actor at this point. He'd been in Scream and some other things. Scream 2, I think, had even been made by this point.
Who was even the biggest star when this came out? Because Clooney was a TV star. He really wasn't a movie star yet.
Might have been Wahlberg because of Boogie Nights and the underwear commercials. And, of course, the New Kids on the Block. Maybe even Ice Cube. They are the three main stars.
Wahlberg was not in New Kids on the Block. His brother was...
Wasn't Wahlberg?
He only had his solo career.
He was Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch. He was the Funky Bunch!
Somebody wasn't a tween girl in the late 80s, and it shows, Brian.
I fail yet again. My tween girlishness. Lacking.
David O. Russell, the director, cast a few non-actors, Spike Jones, Ice Cube, who had acted in things before. It just makes me think, actually, of our last movie, Precious, where you've got a few musicians acting for not their first time. Well, I guess it was for Lenny Kravitz. And again, you have some non-actors acting. Two musicians are two of the three kings, and that's Marky Mark and Ice Cube.
Okay then, so Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 94% of critics like this film. 121 fresh, 8 rotten, for an average of 7.8 out of 10. And 77% of audiences. Pretty solid. I think they're right. I think it's a thumbs up. And it was 39th at the 1999 U.S. box office. The Phantom Menace, as in Star Wars, was number one, of course. The Sixth Sense, we covered that, was number two. The Matrix was number five. We covered that earlier this year. We've covered American Beauty, Fight Club, and other films from 1999, but not nearly enough. So that's one reason why we picked this. And also because things are happening in that part of the world again. Unfortunately, that never seems to end.
Yeah, this film is incredibly current, considering it's 20 years old. It has aged incredibly well because it really nails what's insidious about American foreign relations in the Middle East. And it was one of the first films that I know of to really address that specifically.
Yeah, the war policy of hit him, hit him, hit him, and then pull back.
Encourage them to turn on their leader, their very corrupt leader.
But then don't help them.
And then abandon them. Mm-hmm.
And they get slaughtered. This movie was also nominated for the 2007 AFI Top 100 list. We've covered a few films that were nominated for that one because they couldn't have been nominated for the first one. But yeah, this was. 1999 was a pretty big year for nominees. 2004 was a big year for nominees as well.
Really?
They got The Shining on there, Halloween, I think Stand By Me, movies that weren't nominated the first time but were the second time. And then movies like this that couldn't have been nominated the first time because the list came out in 1998. I don't know if I would quite nominate this for one of the greatest movies of all time, one of the 400 choices for the greatest movies of all time. But I like it. The first time I saw it, I wasn't a big fan. I would say I'm more of a fan now. Chris and I have been rating movies more lately. I would say an 8 out of 10 at least. What about you?
I like it. I've never loved it. personally, I've never really found my way in, maybe because it's a male-driven film. It also feels like it pulls its punches a little by teasing us with this moral ambiguity right off the top to ultimately deliver us a pretty predictable, formulaic hero story in the third act. Also, the look drives me crazy. I think it's gimmicky, and it's just too ugly to commit to for a feature film.
Newton Thomas Siegel, the cinematographer, used this thing called ektachrome, which I don't remember ever hearing about before this movie. Gives you richer blacks, apparently. But you didn't like that, then.
It's ugly. It's one thing to do a few scenes like this. If you were going to style a film and maybe do flashbacks or just certain scenes in this, but it's just too aggressive to do the entire film, and by the end, I am so sick of looking at it.
I think for the originality of it, you could have considered it at least, maybe nominated for the Oscar, just like the editing, maybe could have been nominated for the Oscar. I think this movie's got a hell of a pace, more so early on and at the end, so maybe not the whole movie then, actually. The middle section, like most movies, does sag, but I wasn't bothered by the look the way that you were. So the story is set, of course, in March 1991, the war was ending. It was shot, though, in America. They didn't go over even to, say, Morocco, like some war movies are, or whatever, over in Africa, and then pretend you're in the Middle East. And this is a war comedy, Dr. Strangelove-esque in some ways. We haven't seen that many successful or even attempted war comedies, but it's often very serious. Most of the laughs are early on, maybe to the detriment. I don't know how you find a lot of laughs in the second half when they start realizing, oh, this shit's real. And I always thought this movie wasn't that much of a shoot-em-up, that there weren't that many bullets, but there are a lot more than I remember there being. Because that sequence when it's slow motion, and I think I've seen this somewhere, maybe it's a deleted scene where they show above how it goes bang, 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 all the shots that get fired in the sequence when they decide to take a stand. But because in the movie itself, it's slow motion, you see Clooney's shot, and then this guy's shot in retaliation, and I think Wahlberg finally pulls a gun, and all this kind of thing happens, but it takes forever in the movie to happen. But when they show the overhead shot, it's just boom, 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 and it's over, because it probably would be. And I always remember that being one of the most violent scenes in the whole film, but there's a lot more shooting than I remember there being actually, so it's not a movie without very many bullets. It maybe isn't quite the shoot 'em up we've seen in other war films.
Yeah, I saw somewhere that David O. Russell insisted that since so many war films have so many bullets, as he put it, just so much shooting, that he wanted the film to not actually have that much so that it would have a greater impact. But what are you talking about? There's a scene where somebody just has a machine gun and it has that, what do you call it, when the bullets are kind of like already lined up, ready to go, so you never need to reload. Rambo always wears one, like a sash.
Oh, yeah, the feeding you, Ben.
Yes, feeding you. For Strangelove fans. But they're feeding him, and it's just... And of course, our but heroes aren't really getting
But it's not really Rambo,
shot.
Generally. I wouldn't say it's a Rambo movie, generally. Maybe that one time.
Well, the action scenes are very gun-heavy, at any rate. And there's explosions, and there's explosively loaded Nerf balls.
Yeah.
Cows exploding.
Good setups and payoff, though, and that's a good example of that. Throwing the football, which has that great line, "We can all agree there are many excellent black quarterbacks." Which is more true now. There are quite a few black quarterbacks, although one of them is still on the sidelines because he dared to kneel on the sideline. But yes, so they set that up with the shooting in the desert. They're young, dumb, full of cum. Very much like Jarhead, a movie that you owned. It's put in our collection right now. I think there's a lot of connections to that one as well. But to set up with the exploding cow early on, but what does a cow give? Milk. And then you see the exploded milk truck. It's milk as it goes into the sand. That's a great scene. Because when you first see it, you don't know, why does that look white?
You're
shouldn't
sure
that
it's going to be oil.
Oil, or maybe it's water flammable. Or something, but that's not water either, and it's
And then you,
milk.
You see that the people, of course, are so starving that they're drinking milk out of the sand, and the dogs are eating the dirt. They're starving, they're struggling, and it's a really nice turnaround.
And the exploding football also is paid off later because Chief Ice Cube throws one at a helicopter and takes it out by throwing an exploding football.
Yeah, there's some really nice elegant touches in the script. It's a neat and tidy script. There's not really a lot of extra stuff except for one part, which I will gripe about later. But I'm glad you brought up Jarhead, because I think most people would say that there are two great films made about the Gulf War.
I don't think Jarhead's great. I think it's solid.
I don't think Three Kings is great.
No, I like this one better, though, of the two.
Okay, fine. I like Jarhead better of the two. But there's two good films. I guess if you're going to say like,
I'm a little
two
bit country, she's a little bit rock and roll.
But there, I'm not country. There aren't any great films about the Gulf War.
There have been very few. One of the connections to this movie is there have been so many movies made.
It was a short war with not a lot of action.
Either Iraq War. Very few movies have been made about either Iraq War or Afghanistan They've been very good.
Isn't that interesting?
The Hurt Locker, which you didn't love.
I remember when it started, I remember thinking, well, it'll be interesting to see what cinema does with this war, but truthfully, it's been really hard to touch, and the films that have come out, people have pretty limited interest in. As much as Hurt Locker won Best Picture, it didn't sell that many tickets.
No.
Not that many people saw it, and I don't really know if it's on that many people's shelves.
No, probably not.
But of the two Gulf War films, the two best ones, I guess you could say, this and Jarhead, they are both about the buildup and disappointment of being a soldier in this nearly bloodless war. I mean, bloodless for American soldiers. They got all dressed up with nowhere to go. And it seems to be that the takeaway from that war was the frustration of trained and primed troops that never got to see any action. And also kind of reflecting on the fact that lots of soldiers enlist because they want to commit violence. And it's disappointing when that doesn't pan out for them.
These young guys are shooting at nothing in the middle of the desert as they go on their mission to steal the gold because they were told they could.
Troy, at the very beginning, the very first line, are we shooting people?
Great first line. Great double entendre.
Amazing first line. This is where I say, in a way, the premise disappointed me because it sets up this question that's supposed to make the audience pretty uncomfortable, and then in the end they just gave us heroes. But he shoots the guy, not knowing whether or not he's supposed to shoot him. Because the guy's surrendering, but in a rather sloppy manner, because he's waving his gun around as if it's a white flag, and so he shoots him, he kills him, and people are cheering for him.
But he rubs his head as if he doesn't really know what to think about that.
Yeah, he feels a little conflicted about it, but people's take, especially Conrad, the idiot, granted, but he's like, you got to kill one! You don't have to go home without having killed somebody! Isn't that great?
I like that the opening of the movie, though, is a character saying, are we shooting? Because he's not literally saying this to his director, but that's what you say when you're making a movie, are we shooting?
Yeah.
As not just are we shooting a gun, but are we shooting the movie? You know, another political thing I thought about today that ties into this maybe a little bit? Well, maybe two, actually. This isn't really political, but Saving Private Ryan, we talked about that is a true shoot 'em up. It was out in July of 1998. They started shooting this movie in the end of 1998. And guess what was happening around that same point? So they're influenced to some degree by Saving Private Ryan and maybe the advance word on Thin Red Line, another war film in 98. I think that came out more around Christmas. But the Clinton impeachment had been happening around that same point. And Clinton, apparently, all through the 90s, when he was president, was bombing Iraq, even though there's a notion of, oh, it's peace and prosperity and all this kind of thing. So these people, George Clooney being a liberal lefty and all that kind of stuff, are hearing about how their president is going through an impeachment over some stupid scandal, which is nothing compared to what we see now. And I think that's got something to do with this, too. These people are making this movie very urgent, just rat-a-tat, not even necessarily with guns, but mentality, as they're watching their country maybe be taken over something stupid. And what are they doing? Something selfish, and if you think about it, stupid.
Big
stealing
time.
Gold that they don't need to be stealing. And when Clooney has that line, we're not thieves, we're returning Kuwaiti bullion.
To themselves.
You're not returning it to Kuwaiti, are you kidding me? Who's also really rich, by the way. They probably aren't even going to miss that bullion. I was reading, by the way, bouillon, not the cube in the soup, but it's 99% pure, and it's either in bars or ingot form. That's what's going to give these people a future when they go to Iran, ironically, from Iraq to Iran. Although at that point, I guess, that was the place to go because Iran was, people have talked about it before around the time of 9/11 and maybe even now, but certainly for a lot of those years, this whole notion, no, they're all backwards over there. Apparently Iran for a long time was a very forward-thinking country, mostly.
Yeah, until the revolution.
Maybe not so much their leaders.
Yeah, much like Afghanistan, which was relatively modern
country
until the revolution.
I'm talking more modern than Iran has been like that. Not just into the late 70s.
Oh, okay, but like since then they've...
Because a strong man...
Become more progressive?
Messes everything up. They've got a long way to go, but I've just heard that Iran, of all those countries over there, around the time of this setting of 1991, and maybe even about 10 years later, was not a backwards country.
When you say backwards, you mean human rights, right?
Yes, not a great record on that front, but then what country has a great record on that front anyway?
But Iran really did have a good record on human rights, or at least better than it did. I think mostly about women's rights, because they're the ones that have suffered a great deal under the new regime. It's very strict on them. Same with Afghanistan. They were a relatively modern, progressive country for the Middle East until the Taliban took over and turned everything around.
Armed by America? Watch Charlie Wilson's War for that one. And not surprisingly, this movie was banned in Iraq. I guess Saddam wouldn't want this movie out there. And we do hear the song by Conrad early on. We three kings of Orient are... But it's not the Orient. But I guess that's kind of the point. This guy's a hick and he's an idiot. He's likable and he's very loyal. And you would want him on your side, but Orient. You're nowhere near the Orient.
I don't understand the title at all, though. Are they kings?
And that's also
There's
funny.
Four of them? They're not really acting like kings. They're acting like pirates and thieves.
They're not bringing frankincense and myrrh could leave the moo behind next time. But they are taking...
Give a baby a bomb!
They are taking gold. I guess that's the one connection to anything to do with the three kings that come to see Jesus.
It's not a great title.
Well, it's an original screenplay by John Ridley. Although, then again, it's not his screenplay. David Owen Russell. So that's what the O stands for, Owen. And he is the writer and director of this film. Apparently, John Ridley has only story credit on this. He was also a co-producer. He battled with Russell, but then everyone does. And we'll talk about Clooney in a second. Apparently, Ridley also battled with Steve McQueen on 12 Years a Slave. So I'm wondering if it isn't just the whole thing of, well, the white director is telling the black writer to know his place. Well, the black director also told him to know his place. If you watch the Oscars in 2014, so the 2013 show, when 12 Years a Slave won for Best Picture, Best Supporting Actress, and for the script, when Ridley wins, he goes past Steve McQueen, and I never noticed this. I didn't know this until later on. But McQueen is giving one of those golf claps. Barely seems to acknowledge him whatsoever. I don't think he mentions him in his speech because McQueen spoke for them all when they won Best Picture that night. So I don't know for sure, but it sounds like John Ridley is his own worst enemy because if he's going to fight with David O. Russell, okay, fine. But also Steve McQueen, maybe it's you, pal. But I guess it's his screenplay. I guess it's an original. It's a story credit. I wouldn't say it's a mess. I do feel like, and you said a minute ago, that in the end it becomes what we've seen in other war films before. These guys get a conscience. And what's funny about that, too, is that I always remembered, I haven't seen this movie in quite a few years, that Mark Wahlberg grew the conscience first. But it's Archie. It's George Clooney's character. And maybe Clooney wanted this in the screenplay. Maybe it just happened to be in the screenplay. But he sees this guy. And why does that soldier shoot the woman in the head? They want these guys to leave because they think that they've got to protect their base. Well, not really a base, but this compound. These guys have found the gold they didn't find the first time they went in there. And by the way, when they first go in there, they're covered in cow's blood, which looks like just blood. And they go in there quick and hard and fast. And that would have worked in the first place, but then they don't get the gold. Then they go back in, they get the gold. They're about to leave, but it's Clooney who sees this guy shoot this woman in the head. Poor Alia Shotgun sees her mother get shot in front of her for no good reason because she's mouthing off a little bit. If they had just waited for these guys to leave and do the same thing, as awful as it is, then they don't have any of these kinds of problems. But that's when Archie gets the conscience. And I thought Troy did as well or first, but no, Troy's still doing the whole sort of, what are we doing? Oh, fine, I'll pull my handgun and I'll cover you, but I don't want to.
Yeah.
It's only after Troy gets tortured, and I do like Troy's character. I think Wahlberg plays him really well. But it's only after he's being tortured by Saeed later on in the film, having oil poured down his throat with a CD allowing it to happen as well. CD case.
This is the part that I'm going to rip on, is the torture stuff.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But Clooney's the one, Archie Gates is the one that finally grows the conscience, and they all seem to realize we have to do something. But so, there shouldn't be there in the first place.
So I love George Clooney, just like everybody else in the world. But I think there's something missing from his performance in this one. I'm not convinced that he's the type of person who would both risk his life and his pension to go treasure hunting, and the type of person who would risk his treasure and his pension to protect Iraqi citizens. Actually, the second one is far more convincing as far as his performance. It's much more hard to believe that he's either desperate or foolhardy enough to convince these three other relative strangers.
Definitely strangers.
To go on this mission with him in the first place. I just don't buy it. Why is he hunting the treasure? You never really understand it.
He hears secondhand that they have the map and then just capitalizes on that. But I think I'm agreeing with what I think you just said, which is when he hangs his head and realizes, nope. Something's got to be done about this. And he grabs the gun. When the guy shoots the gun, he's holding with his hand. It reminds me of the Scarface story. Pacino actually grabbed a gun that had blanks in it, that kind of thing. And he burned his hand and they had to shut down filming for a little while. If you're holding a gun, especially a machine gun, and you don't get shot with it, okay, fine. You're strong enough, you make sure. And then the guy also is banging against the side of the Humvee and not making Archie lose his grip. Tough guy. He would have, but okay, beyond all that.
You would hear his skin sizzling.
Probably, yeah. Because that's a really hot barrel. But Archie's the one that grows the conscience. I actually buy that more than him going on the raid in the first place. Because he's the one that says earlier on to Bubba Gump. Well, not Bubba Gump, but Bubba. Michael T. Williamson, who plays his superior officer, Colonel Horn. If his guys didn't call him horny, then they're stupid and they're not baseball fans. Because that's the lamest name of all time. And that's what a baseball person would call him. Colonel Horn, gotta call him horny. Anyway,
he's their superior officer.
They still call him horny behind his back. Anyway, so Archie's the one that says to superior, I don't even know what we accomplished here, Ron. So he seems to care. He seems to think, what is this bullshit? He's probably been on many other missions through the 80s, because this course is 91, so he's seen other things in this region, probably. So he seems to care. So why is he treasure hunting? And then making this claim, no, we're taking back gold for the Kuwaitis. No, you're not. You were never going to give that to the Kuwaitis. You want to keep it all yourself.
You buy it that Troy would be this selfish and foolhardy.
Until he is converted and you don't like that. Okay, we'll address that.
Oh, okay, so let's talk about the torture scene. This, for me, is where the film gets way too sanctimonious, way too on the nose. Saeed spares no detail when explaining to this vapid meathead...
My man.
...exactly what America did bro. And why we should care, brah. Then he literally, like you say, uses a CD case to make Troy drink crude oil, and it's as if the scene was written by a political cartoonist. I'm not saying the rest of the film is subtle. We get it.
What about the fact that when they do save Troy, that Troy says, no, spare him, don't shoot him dead. Because earlier Saeed had talked about how his family was killed with American bombs.
Well, this is the part where, to me, the film loses its guts. And it starts out as this really interesting, ambiguous film. And then we're not going to let our heroes do anything evil anymore. We're even going to let them spare the bad guys. I buy it because I buy Wahlberg's performance.
I think he sells it quite well.
Yeah, he really does.
He took a real shock, incidentally. They hooked him up to this machinery.
Whoa, really?
And it wasn't just fake. It was real. So he said, give me a shock. I'm a young actor. I want to prove myself. So I guess the shot where he's kind of like Nicholson in a cuckoo's nest. And in Boogie Nights, he has a scene like Nicholson the Cuckoo's Nest. The scene in Boogie Nights and in Cuckoo's Nest, when the main actor just zones out for a while and nothing really happens for about 10 or 15 seconds. That was an homage. So maybe this was an homage too. I'm going to be the new Jack Nicholson, even though he has nothing in common with him. Oh, he worked with them in a way in The Departed.
What's the Laurence Olivier line?
Don't you try acting.
Why don't you try acting?
Wahlberg and Nicholson in those two movies, and I think Nicholson's wasn't, but Wahlberg's apparently was. Real shocks. They sell it really well, let's put it that way.
I think in a way, Nicholson sells it better, maybe because he's acting what we think a shock is supposed to look like, where Wahlberg just looks like he's gritting his teeth really hard, but that's probably what you react to. That goes on, too. He's being shocked for quite a long time when they do that scene. It's not just like a quick zap and they're done with.
In Three Kings.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't buy the middle section, because that is the worst part of this movie, the middle section. That's true about so many films. I think the opening is outstanding. I think the closing is touching, even though I don't necessarily completely buy everything. But then I think that the actors have sold it well enough. The script has sold it well enough that these guys have grown to care. I love the sequence where Archie is trying to get them all riled up. A free Iraq! America has won! Yay, all nations! And you got a white guy, and you got a black guy, and an Iraqi guy all holding hands. And then, no, I'm not going to help you. Okay, we'll buy the cars then. That's one of the last comedy touches in the whole movie, because it does get pretty serious towards the end. Whenever we cut to Adriana Cruz, Nora Dunn, who had been on SNL, I think around this point, or maybe before this, she's pretty funny in this movie too, when they see the birds. Fucking birds are covered in oil. Yeah. She and Jamie Kennedy are a little bit of a side plot.
Birds.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern side plot,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Which kind of feels pointless until at the end, of course. She's
the media saves the day.
Paramount.
That could have been my nutshell as much as anything else. Media saves the day, because if they weren't there, then Colonel Horn and his guys would have completely sold these guys down the river.
And if you never established that she as a character would do anything for a good story, then you wouldn't necessarily buy that she would report it despite all of these military superiors clearly trying to dissuade her and discourage anybody from taking part in helping the refugees.
She probably would have fucked Archie, but Judy Greer got to that earlier on.
Do you think that's what they're implying? That she's mad at Judy Greer because she wanted to fuck Clooney?
No, I'm just making
a
joke.
Yeah, I don't feel that.
Not
I mean,
about that. She wants a story.
That, like, everybody wants to fuck Clooney, but she wants a story more than she wants anything.
She's a bit of a play on Christiane Amanpour, I think, was during this war where she made her name. And I think you even said during the movie, speaking of Clooney and his fuckability, that he's, what, a 12?
Oh, this was him at his peak. And this is a man whose whole lifetime has been a peak.
Who's still peaking.
Who's still peaking, like,
20 years later.
60, however old he is now. It is, like, staring directly at the sun.
One of the great contrasts in the film, and I think it's pretty subtle, is that early on you see the young guys partying. And apparently they're drinking booze, colored vodka, in those mouthwash bottles, because there's no alcohol in Iraq.
A dry country.
A lot of other countries over there. Funny, though, that you're going to invade a country. They didn't invade, did they? But you're going to have a war with somebody and you're going to respect their religious rules.
Well, they also launched that war from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
Oh, right.
Which are dry countries. Saudi Arabia in particular is very strictly a dry country. Of course, very strictly with caveats for people who are rich enough. There are a lot
do
of
do whatever you want to,
Saudi
yeah.
Arabia.
But then the story changes from people that are pissed off they didn't get to do anything fighting-wise. Jarhead is really about that. This movie's only somewhat about that. And we see the media misreporting the story. Adriana and also Kathy really not reporting the story properly. But then most of the movie is about these refugees, the real people that always get hurt in war, And not that many war films that I can think of, especially major ones. This isn't necessarily a major, major film. This one, for at least half the running time, is about the nobodies. The Cliff Curtis family, Amir and his daughter, and for a little while, for she gets her head shot off, his wife. And then all their friends. Now, you didn't really buy that the guys converted their, if you want to call that converted, interesting use of words, because in some ways, Conrad converts to their religion briefly.
Yeah.
He's known these people for hours or maybe a day or so.
He prays with them.
And then he wants to be buried wherever they're going, which I guess would be a Ram long term. I'm not a religious person, that's been very clear on this podcast, but I suppose if you're going to buy into your own religion and then share it with somebody else, then maybe that's the way to go. If you're going to believe in a higher power, and one person believes in Jesus, somebody else believes in Allah, another person believes in Buddha, I guess.
That's all.
Then all do it together.
Very lovely as a sentiment, and yet somehow it doesn't seem to translate very
well. I don't want to pray to any of these people. But these main characters, not so much Archie, because he's a lifer. I guess he's going to retire soon.
And I think that they're trying to illustrate, both with Conrad and with Ice Cube, that they very quickly develop a true respect for this culture. In the beginning of the film, they have all these bad ethnic slurs that they call them, and they have an argument about
especially Conrad.
Which slurs are okay and which slurs are not okay. They quickly, after just meeting a few of them and learning about their plight, they respect them and then change their mind. It's just about humanizing the enemy, a thing that most films don't do, and most soldiers don't do, right? It's a lot easier to kill somebody if you convince them that they're not really people, they don't really count, they're very othered.
Our main characters, we see their lives back home. Troy working with printers. Seems like a job that's harried and he's under the gun. Maybe he doesn't even want to do that job. Chief, Elgin, Ice Cube in the airport. Doesn't seem like he really wants to do that job. Conrad shooting guns. Seems to enjoy that.
I don't really do nothing back home. Yeah. He's just shooting cans off of, like,
so what do they have to look forward to? Now, Troy has a wife, and she's really cute. Liz Stauber is a lot of fun as the Goonie Bird wife. But the other guys seem to have nothing back home. And then we see what wars should be about more often, or should be mentioned more often, which is the innocent people that get caught up in this. And these guys go from being guys who went over to do this whole thing, maybe earn a little bit of money, then they want to experience the joy of maybe killing, certainly of shooting off a gun. Don't get that. Then they do get that, and then they realize, oh no, this is bigger than me. But it's funny that the last convert of all of them, and I always thought when I think back on this movie that Wahlberg was the first, but really, if you think about it, of the four main guys, he's the last one to be converted. And then he's really converted. It's actually one of the last laughs, maybe this is one of the last laughs in the movie, when he comes out and he sees Cliff Curtis's character, and Troy's been tortured, he's had oil poured down his throat. For some reason, he probably should be vomiting. Well, obvious reason, should be vomiting.
Should be very sick.
Absolutely, how can we help you? Anything we can do to help you? And he's obviously got PTSD. Then he gets shot and he has to do the thing in his lungs to keep himself alive for a little while there. But it's just funny that he's the one who has the family back home, in a way has the most to look forward to, and there's a shitty job. But he's the one that takes the longest to get that this is bigger than you. It always was. It's always people like Saeed, who may be a bad guy for torturing you. And he was one of the ones, I think, anyway, that was torturing Amir only hours before.
I feel like Wahlberg is playing it as if he is a short-term memory guy. He just takes what's in front of him as it is. So when his superior officer is talking him into going on a treasure hunt, he goes on a treasure hunt. But when that plan gets kiboshed and then suddenly he's being asked to help these refugees, he just helps these refugees. He just kind of deals with tasks as they're presented to
him.
But
he does that because of what happened with his own torture.
Sure, sure.
This guy telling him,
and
look what I went through.
And moved him, yeah, because he's like, we're both parents. He goes, I'm not the parent anymore because the Americans killed my little daughter.
You didn't love that sequence, but did you not like Saeed Taghoumi, I think I say his name, performance?
I like him. I like him as an actor. He's one of those actors that I've seen 100 things and I can't name a single one now, but I think he did his best with some on-the-nose sanctimony. Okay. Amir, Cliff Curtis's character, is only marginally better. He is Mr. Exposition. He's constantly telling them what's going on around them, and he's telling instead of showing why they should be taking a moral stance about what's going on and helping these people. He seems to be the only one that speaks English. What does he say? He had bakeries or something? Some kind of
very
shop.
Ordinary life, yeah.
Yeah, but he's like, oh, I was successful, and I was doing exactly what Americans wanted me to do,
and
now I'm running for my life.
Yeah, and you bombed what I did for a living. Two guys want to be hairdressers. The credits here on the list: hairdressing twin number one and hairdressing twin number two.
Yeah, they're just like regular people. It's a very relatable thing. That's actually a really nice touch to me, that they gave them jobs and histories and names, and then, well, maybe not hairdressers, but it is like a really relatable thing. Everybody knows a hairdresser.
Also, the Iraqi soldiers, the quote-unquote bad guys, plenty of the dialogue they have is them being afraid of Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even set up by the one guy saying, what are they most afraid of? Saddam. They just want to go home to their families, too. Not to say that soldiers in the history of wars, any war, name it, World War II, this war, any of the current wars, the other side isn't always innocent. Certainly our side isn't always innocent. But the way these guys are portrayed is that, and including Saeed to a big degree, who's our main torturer, bad guy, whatever you want to call him, is a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw this last month in October with so many of the villains, and I sided with so many of them to a degree.
You always side with the villains.
Because if you do a movie right, then you give them mm-hmm. motivation and you mm-hmm. make it interesting. If you just make them a bad guy and there's no motivation, then that's dull and it's too easy. A lot of horror films go on that notion. A lot of war films, most war films go like that. We've seen plenty of war films like Platoon. And I can't think of another one. There's another one for sure where you don't see the enemy at all. Not close-ups, at least. Which is smart in their cases, Platoon especially. It doesn't really matter because the real enemies, and Charlie Sheen's over-the-top voiceover really hammers it on the head, we really fought ourselves. I think we got that. But this movie is all about, let's meet the people that aren't the ones shooting at you anyway. They actually help you out. You could have choked to death in the desert or probably been recaptured by the Iraqis, tortured and probably killed or given to Saddam or whatever. But these people that you would look at as your enemy that actually save you and eventually help you, and then you have to help them get across the border. And even though some of it doesn't always work, that touched me towards the end. These guys finally do the right thing. They didn't get any of the money, but they've learned something that matters,
they
especially
got
Archie's
Conrad
character.
Conrad killed?
Well, like Anthony Hopkins says in Legends of the Fall, he became a soldier, and soldiers die!
It's weird that they do present it as if these three guys get this happy ending when a lot of people died, including their buddy that didn't have to, and probably wouldn't have if they hadn't gotten greedy.
That's probably
one,
probably one of the subtexts in this film, too, is that when America, and it doesn't have to be America, but in this case it's America, decides to plant their fingers into something, even something as simple as this, which could have just been a smash and grab, get the hell out of there, and who would have been the wiser? They bury the gold in the desert, they go back for it later on, and they're really rich when they go back to their regular lives. That's what the plan was. Because things get messed up, look how many people die because you guys are being greedy. But at least they learned a lesson. Now, I'm going to ask you what happens next. I have an idea. We learn at the end of the film through some of the title cards and some of the action happening that Archie and Chief end up working together in Hollywood, and Troy has a different job and seems like he's a happier guy working with his family.
He has his own business.
In California, which is where, of course, obviously Clooney and Ice Cube have gone to, too. So I think what happens next is that Clooney recruits them for an Ocean's heist because they're all in the same state now.
Yes. So my what happens next, I'm going to refer to something that happened in real life, according to David O. Russell, which is that when he was making this film, he happened to meet George W. Bush before he was president, because as you said, Clinton was president. He said to him, I'm making a movie that is not all that flattering to your father's legacy in Iraq. And George W. Bush's response, according to Russell, was, well, I guess I'm just going to have to go in there and finish the job.
Well, people have talked about how especially Dick Cheney, but even Bush and other people, wanted more than anything else to have a reason to attack Saddam Hussein. And they made an excuse of 9/11. That became the reason to attack a whole different country. What? Oh, they're the bad guy.
And we know that they were lying about the intelligence that they used to rationalize it. David O. Russell is trying to make the case for that. So my what happens next is America goes back to Iraq and really fucks it up this time.
That's also true.
I know.
What happens next should be a speculation that's fun. That was actually very true.
But that time they did take out Saddam, at least.
The trivia question did get into this a little bit. The description of what happens when you're shot. This movie is very original in that way. When you see the sequence when supposedly Troy gets shot, the bullet goes through him, and then the pus and the bile gets in there. And it's interesting that he does get shot because the most important shooting in the movie, well, maybe Conrad because he dies, but he's not one of the three kings. Well, really, when Amir's wife gets shot, you see that same angle of the guys from low, the camera's low, and it's Clooney and it's Wahlberg and it's Ice Cube with the clouds zooming over their head, fast forward zooming of the clouds. It's not Conrad. It's the other three guys. So they are the three kings, really. And of course, they're the three that survive at the end. But even though Troy's not the one who gets shot first, he's the one who gets shot of those three, at least. That's the most important because he could die if he doesn't keep on getting the
valve.
And Jim Gaffigan has to cut his cuffs to continue to allow him to do that. That's something I'd never seen in a film before.
No, it's like a really great little touch in the script. Russell asked medics and doctors, what's the craziest thing that you ever saw, to tell them stories that people hadn't seen before. And one of them was the bile that you see shown in animation at the beginning of the film, and the other one was the collapsed lung, and the way a collapsed lung can kill you is just not how you think. Bullets don't kill you the way that you think they do. What a great little tension builder that he needs to release his valve every 15 minutes while his lung is healing up. Soldiers that just don't trust him and don't know what he's talking about because it seems like such an unusual thing, and only a medic would understand it necessarily, are at risk of just being too stupid to understand that they have to let his hands free or release the valve so that he can live. And you buy the tension every time I see this film. Somebody release the valve! I get so upset about it. It's such a great little touch.
Well, if Troy had been talking about Hot Pockets, then I think it would have been fine.
Hot Pockets.
Jim Gaffigan would have been all over that. So I said the middle section of this movie is the weakest part, even though some of the nice scenes are in there too, because you've got the whole God bless a free Iraq and God bless all these other things. That's a lot of fun. You didn't love the Troy and Saeed sequence, but okay, fine. In that scene alone, there's an awful lot of shooting. And we see Saeed is allowed to live, Conrad dies, Troy's shot, and then we get to the end of the movie. I guess in a way, the story is trying to say the death of even one man weighs heavily for them. You didn't think it did. I think it did. It mattered to them that Conrad was shot. The movie spends time with them, mourning their, well, it's not really their friend, it's more Troy's friend, but all of them, Archie, Troy, Chief, are all sitting around, as are the Iraqis. It matters. They barely know this guy, except for Troy, and maybe Chief somewhat. The Iraqis really didn't know him very well, and they all seem to care.
I think what bothers me is that they don't suffer any consequences for this. A man lost his life because of their poor decision-making, and no matter how much the press spins it, it's wild that they just get honorably discharged and go on with their lives and are probably rich. They probably got away with at least some gold. There was never a court-martial. You got a soldier killed, an American soldier.
Part of the subtext is probably that Colonel Horn and whoever he'd report to...
Horny!
don't really care that much. It doesn't really matter. The war is over. These guys went AWOL for about a day. Not cool. Really not cool. Chris and I just talked about that recently on Lionheart, how he goes AWOL. And in the end, he's allowed to go back to his family, which is really stupid. It ruined that movie. That movie wasn't great anyway. I thought it was okay. It was better than I thought it was going to be. But when he is allowed to go back to his family by these two guys, and they're going to be punished for letting him go, that was stupid. I buy more in this case, I think, because it could be covered up. It'd be so much easier for the colonel to cover it up for whatever reason. He maybe got some of that gold, too. You're going to show me where that gold is right now.
And it's the end of the war. They probably just want to wrap it up and get out of there and go home. They aren't really interested in a long, drawn-out justice process at this point.
I don't know that much about the first Gulf War, but I like one of the sequences. I think it's in W, where the president, so George Bush the first, is complimenting would-be Cheney and Powell. Cheney was the Secretary of Defense back then, and I think Powell was the Joint Chiefs head, whatever they call that job. Anyway, they were the two that he's congratulating in that scene. And the idea is we push Saddam back, and now it's going to be fine. And the way that scene is painted in W, a whole different filmmaker, a whole different movie, many years after this, by Oliver Stone, is that George Bush the first thought he did the right thing. And I think I've said this to you in other movies we've talked about, which is, Jesus Christ, either go all the way, I'm not saying nukes, but fight the war properly. Don't kick somebody on the ground once and say, well, he's never getting up again. No wonder Saddam continued to be a problem for the next 10 years, more than 10 years. Because they were just defending, and I said this earlier on in the film, the oil, and now in some ways the gold. But it was about the oil in the end. We all knew that was true anyway. We certainly do now.
It's about America, and particularly the Bush relationship with Saudi Arabia, who was very interested in Americans fighting this war for them and protecting Kuwait. And there is a great deal, an incredible, unbelievable amount of money in that part of the world controlled by a very small group of people.
So the performance is George Clooney. You notice how much he squinted in this film? Which makes sense. It is the desert. It's really sunny. He's got the Clint Eastwood squint going on. He was still on ER at this point. He was a TV star, of course, that went into movies. That's become more common now, where TV guys or TV women become movie stars. But back then, that was still pretty uncommon. 2 years before this was Batman and Robin. Ugh. He mocks it himself, but has gone on to win Oscars in Syriana for acting and Argo for producing. He's one of the best things going. I've liked him for a long time. I like him, what I know of him as a person. Seems like he's a pretty good guy. Clint Eastwood, Nicolas Cage, Nick Nolte, Mel Gibson, so many others were suggested for the role. David O. Russell didn't want him for this role in the first place, but there is that story about Clooney and Russell fighting over the way Russell treated extras, and apparently it was a fist fight.
Neither of them deny it. They fought fisticuffs.
But I'm wondering now if it was a misunderstanding in the end, and they seem like they've looked back and thought, well, we made a good movie together, so, oh well.
Clooney said, Do I think that Russell made a good movie and that he should get nominated for Oscars? Yes. Would I ever work with David again as long as I live? No.
And 5 years later, he's making I Heart Huckabees and going on one of the most epic director rants in the history of filmmaking business.
We talk all the time about how certain people, actors, directors, can be, quote, difficult, and how women in Hollywood frequently are not cast because they have a bad reputation. But David O. Russell is just the quintessential example of somebody who, no matter how bad his attitude is, he still continues to get away with being an absolute petty, pouting bully, and gets to keep making all the movies he wants. Actors do work with him over and over again. I mean, Jennifer Lawrence has worked with him 3 times.
And Bradley Cooper as well.
Yeah.
And Silver Linings is a movie I liked a lot. I saw it again not that long ago. Didn't like it quite as much. I still love that moment when they managed to cover the spread and the dance. They had
dance
to get a 5.
Oh my God.
And they realized that their mediocre 5 out of 10 dance. The look on Cooper and Lawrence's face, and then when they cut to De Niro and that group. God, that's the best moment in that whole movie. It's so sweet and so cool.
I agree that I didn't like that movie nearly as much the second time I saw it, but damn, it is entertaining and full of complexity and fun to talk about, too. But it might be my favorite of his films. I'm not really the biggest David O. Russell fan.
Me neither. I didn't love American Hustle.
Yeah, respect for a guy that takes chances and makes movies that are popular-ish and weird. I respect a weird filmmaker, man.
Well, a lot of people love Flirting with Disaster. He did with Ben Stiller and a lot of other pretty big stars.
Kind of a cult comedy hit, yeah.
And The Fighter was popular. I didn't love it. Chris and I might cover that one of these days, maybe next year, because I believe it was 2010, so that would make it 10 years old. We didn't love American Hustle. We covered that for the Now Playing Project a long time ago. So yeah, I'm not necessarily his biggest fan either. Mark Wahlberg, though, worked with him in I Heart Huckabees not that long after
and
this.
And The Fighter, of course.
And then The Fighter a few years after that. So yeah, obviously Wahlberg likes him quite a bit. I've mentioned The Perfect Storm with Clooney. He did the year after this and then Boogie Nights a couple years before. He also had to be shirtless at least once, and he was. Show off that great
contract.
Body. Mark Wahlberg's an actor that's interesting in a lot of things. I think he's pretty good in this film. I think he makes the character's turn work well. What do you think of Wahlberg in general? He's had a pretty good career, and now he is, much like James Wan, who's a director, but I talked about this on Saw, effectively a mogul. Ice Cube, too, for that matter. Ice Cube as a producer and as an actor, and of course as a rap star, which he's still best known for, I guess. These guys are bigger, and Clooney, too, I guess, as a producer and other things he's done. These guys are bigger than just being movie stars. All three of those guys are. The three kings are.
I think the key to Wahlberg is that he's very good at knowing what he's going to be very good at. He's never trying to push himself or test himself. He just picks films where he knows he can shine as himself. He doesn't have a ton of range, or he's never really tried to show a lot of range. You're never going to catch this guy in a period film. He has a great screen presence and a unique charm. And he has his own reputation as far as being a ball buster and knows how to ask for what he wants and to get it. And, of course, reputation for doing some questionable things in his youth.
Putting a guy in the hospital.
Yeah, for a hate crime that ended up leaving the guy blind in one eye. I can't remember where the guy was actually from, but Wahlberg, I think, may have been drunk at the time. Started calling him a slur for Vietnamese and beat him up for that.
How dare he be from there?
He was not from there.
No, but even if he was.
Right, this is not right anyway.
Yeah, we talked about a lot of the actors in this movie who are either good supporting players in a ton of things. We've talked about the big stars, but Cliff Curtis and I think I said his name wrong, but Saeed Taghmaoui? I don't know how you say his name, but Taghmaoui. Michael T. Williamson, Forrest Gump, of course, Bubba. He was also in Heat a couple years before. There's Jamie Kennedy, who's fun in this. Nora Dunn, Jodie Greer. And then actual Iraqi refugees. They cast people that knew about this stuff. The movie's 239-1. We watched the DVD, which you didn't like the look of, by Newton Thomas Siegel, who shot a lot of movies with Bryan Singer, including The Usual Suspects, which we covered a couple years ago. And we've been hearing lately with Bryan Singer that beyond anything he's ever done with young boys and whatever that might entail, because Singer just leaves the set a lot of the time, that Siegel may have directed a lot of the movies that Singer gets credit for directing.
God. But what a piece of work that guy is. Singer, I mean.
Yeah. The editor, Robert Lambert. He also cut Blue Chips, which Chris and I are going to cover in a few days on Scoring at the Movies, and also Blue Sky in 1994, the same year, Blue Chips and Blue Sky. And the composer, Carter Burwell, with his Birdman-esque score. A lot of drums in this. I'd forgotten that. It really does sound a lot like Birdman, which came many years later. He did the music for Adaptation, which we did a couple years ago. Also, his only ever nominations, Carol and 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, his only nominations despite all those great scores for the Coens, including, of course, Fargo. He's never won anything, never been nominated for any of the Coen scores. It's very fitting, actually, he hasn't been. It's almost like Bernard Herrmann with Alfred Hitchcock. Never once nominated for any of the Hitchcock scores, which is shocking, of course. And also the fun soundtrack in this. I'm going to talk about this in a few days on Blue Chips with Chris, that the music in that doesn't really suit the movie at all. But in this movie, it does suit it, including the Bart Simpson doll in the Humvee. This movie is really trying to set itself back in 1991, when things were big, with a lot of those kinds of songs, a lot of those kinds of themes, like Bart Simpson.
Russell did a ton of research and read a lot of interviews, looked at photographs so that he could get the touches like the Bart Simpson doll and the right songs to play when they're partying.
So you didn't love the look of the movie. You mentioned that already with the ektachrome thing. But what about the cutting and the score?
No complaints about the editing. I think it sets a great pace. It's an action film. It pretty much kills it. I do like the score. First of all, it's cool. It's jazzy. It's Birdman-esque. I love the sound of it. And second of all, it was a score that did not impose itself on you and tell you what to feel.
It didn't insist upon itself. All right, then last thoughts on three, but should have been Four Kings.
So it is refreshing to see a war film that has this level of political criticism, unflattering realism. It's funny, it's refreshingly original, but the story itself never has grabbed me. The look and style I find actively annoying. I'll chalk those things up to personal tastes and add points for the prescience. Telling a story that is never going to stop being relevant as long as there's American troops in the Middle East, it has aged remarkably well because they completely nailed exactly what is fucked up about that situation.
Some people have said that the reason why Bin Laden and some of the others are so mad and why they wanted to attack on 9/11 was because of America's presence in the Middle East. It may not be as simple as that, but if that's true, then God, that's what Trump has said he wants to do, is get out of there. But he wants to get out of there because his boss told him to get out of there. He's an operative, after all, for Russia.
Yeah, comrade.
Anyway, a little more political stuff in here. Yeah, this is an enjoyable war comedy. I mentioned Dr. Strangelove earlier in the podcast. Isn't quite at that level. In fact, it's not even close to that level with the humor. The first 30 minutes is pretty funny, though. But then they grow a conscience, and then it loses some of the humor. I guess that makes some sense. I was touched by the ending. These guys all waving as if they really care about... They did care about these people. They weren't pretending to. They really did care that these people got to Iran and they had a future. One thing about the Cliff Curtis character, though, and I guess you could say this is just expeditious and maybe they also had some deleted scenes, but Amir, who watched his wife get shot, his daughter's traumatized. They even mentioned that. What's wrong with her? She watched her mother get shot. What do you think's wrong with her? But Amir himself seems to recover pretty fast from that. But I guess it's just so you can get through the story and that makes some sense. Well, you get an actor with gravitas like Cliff Curtis and it does... play fine. I never really noticed that so much until this viewing, that he doesn't seem to react too much to his wife getting shot.
Well, he needs to keep his act together so that he can be Mr. Exposition.
But I said earlier in this podcast that the death of one man can weigh heavily, but the death of one woman really does too, because these guys wouldn't have done anything. They would have gotten out of there with that gold and let these people be slaughtered, because it wasn't their job. It is going against their orders. They weren't supposed to do what they did, even if it had been a good act rather than stealing gold. But when Archie sees that happen, he finally takes a stand.
Yeah, the film truly turns on that moment.
So Amir's wife getting killed is terrible, but maybe all these people getting out and having their lives saved is because she got killed. It's awful to say, but it's probably at least partly true.
Yeah, you're right.
And this movie, unfortunately, the storyline has not aged, and we've been seeing that a lot the last few months. Okay, so tip your cap to a soldier today, because we covered this movie since it is Veterans Day in America and Remembrance Day in Canada, and a holiday where I work, although I'll be working tonight and getting paid extra money. Because that's the way it works there.
I'll be working and not getting
Most
paid.
Of you do. It's interesting. Right. All the holidays we get that are stupid and made up and bullshit. And one of these that people say, I respect the soldiers. And then a holiday like this isn't even a holiday. Yeah. Unless you're a CBC employee or, I guess, the government.
Because you technically work for the government. So.
Yeah. In 7 days, we'll be away on vacation. I said not long ago we wouldn't have any more breaks till the end of the year. But then we didn't know we were going to go on vacation. So we won't be posting a podcast because we'll be away. When we return on November 25th, we're going to let Kermit, Piggy, Animal, and Fozzie charm us as we drive our Studebaker across the country in The Muppet Movie. The coming attractions trivia for The Muppet Movie. Who is the best Muppet, and who's the best of the guest stars in this picture? I think both of those are facts. But let's generously call this an opinion question.
I think the second part is a fact. The first part, we are definitely going to come to blows with. So the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about the Muppet movie. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles. In exchange for all of this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. You can enjoy a one-time 20% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the promo code top100project at checkout. And that's all one word, top100project, and it's not case sensitive. We need to end this podcast.
Outstanding. Excellent. How can we help you?
And cut.
Oh, that's how.